Remember those endless summer days that felt like they just last forever? Sun rays kiss your skin, grass tickles your toes as you bite into the creamy popsicle melting in your hand. Pure, unbothered bliss. Capture more sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. This nostalgic vanilla flavor with notes of candied orange can help keep you hydrated while savoring your favorite golden hour moments. No matter how hot your summer gets, just one stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water hydrates you better than water alone. It's three times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, with 8 vitamins and nutrients for refreshing on-the-go hydration. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout. That's code INDULGE20 at liquidiv.com.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
And it is our day 2 recap of the trial of Karen Reed. If you missed it because, you have a job and you're working, we're going to break it all down for you here in the next handful of minutes. So you don't have to watch every single minute. But if you want to, we have that option for you on our podcast feed. And of course, also here on YouTube, as we are going to be breaking down all of it and giving you the raw pieces from the courtroom as well. But today, it all started with a taillight, not a weapon, not a confession, not some smoking gun in a dusty evidence bag, a busted taillight on the back of a Lexus SUV. And yet, here we are, months into courtroom showdowns and media frenzies, watching that tiny piece of red plastic take center stage again in the Commonwealth's case against Karen Reed. And I want to remind you, if you're on YouTube, please, in the comment section, let us know what you think. Give us your insights into how you felt day 2 went. Day 2 of the trial wasted no time diving into what prosecutors hope the jury will see as the turning point. Kerry Roberts, a longtime friend of John O'Keefe, took the stand and told the story that's now been repeated across headlines and kitchen tables throughout Massachusetts. The frantic search, the snowbank, and the words that Karen allegedly spoke that morning. It's somewhere around 5 a.m. and on January 29th of 2022, Karen Reed is driving around in a panic. She can't find her boyfriend, John O'Keefe, a Boston police officer. He never came out after that night out, or came home after that night out. She's convinced something's wrong. Riding with her is Kerry Roberts, helping her search the quiet, snowy neighborhood of Canton. Now, this isn't just he didn't call me back kind of concern. Reed reportedly was in full meltdown mode, and according to Roberts, it wasn't long before she asked a question that hit like a punch to the gut. Do you think I hit him? That one line became the spark for the prosecution's narrative. I mean, think about it. They've got no surveillance video showing the moment of impact, no neighbor saying they watched her run someone over. What they do have is a friend on the witness stand recalling that question, allegedly asked while Reed stared at her own broken taillight and wondered out loud if she could have struck her boyfriend without realizing it. Now, in fairness, that question could mean a lot of things. Panic, confusion, guilt, or even just fear. But the prosecution sees it differently. To them, that question is less of a cry for help and more of a gotcha moment. Their job is to convince the jury that Karen Reed knew exactly what happened, or at the very least, suspected it, and that she was already trying to grapple with what she'd done. As Roberts continues testifying, she says that after driving to the party house on Fairview Road, the one where O'Keefe had supposedly been dropped off the night before, Karen noticed something in the snow, a shape, a figure, maybe a nightmare coming to life. She pulled over and said, "There he is," and ran out of the car. They found John O'Keefe lying in the snow, unresponsive. And it was here, Robert says, that Reed began to spiral, screaming, running in circles. repeating one thing over and over. Did I hit him? Did I hit him? Not to mention, she did find John O'Keefe in the snow where no one else could see him because he was covered in snow from head to toe by quite a bit. She knew right where he was. Interesting fact. Prosecutors are latching onto the parts of did I hit him? Could I have hit him? They're pointing to it as what they call consciousness of guilt, not just a woman devastated by her boyfriend's condition, but a woman who, in their words, had already internalized her role in it. They want the jury to believe those were the cries of someone whose guilt had already surfaced out loud, raw, and unfiltered. But here's where it starts to get sticky, because the defense, they're not letting this slide. Alan Jackson, Reed's attorney, used cross-examination to poke at the timeline. Why he asked, did Carrie Roberts leave out this alleged taillight conversation when she first talked to police? Why did this crucial moment only show up in later interviews? Was it an oversight, a memory that resurfaced, or something that changed over time? That's the strategy. The defense isn't just trying to dispute what was said. They're trying to suggest that what was remembered may have been reconstructed. Memory, after all, is a slippery thing, especially when tragedy enters the room. Jackson zeroed in on the broken taillight itself. Robert said Reed noticed it during the search, linking it to the possibility she'd hit someone or something. But Jackson implied something far more cynical. What if the damage didn't exist until after police had impounded the car? What if the evidence didn't come from the scene, but from somewhere else entirely? The defense is planting that seed. Maybe the forensic breadcrumbs the state is so confidently lying out were either misunderstood or manipulated. And then the prosecution. They dropped what might be their most powerful card so far. Midway through testimony, they played a clip of Karen Reed's own interview. An interview she gave a journalist not long after the incident. And in that clip, jurors heard her say in her own voice that she picked up pieces of broken taillight from the driveway where John was found and dropped them there during the search. Now, it's hard to walk back from that one. Yeah. Here's why that matters. This wasn't a police report. This wasn't someone else's testimony. This was Karen Reed describing, in her own words, that she found her taillight fragments, on or near the driveway where her boyfriend was later pulled out of a snowbank. Prosecutors are probably grinning behind their notes on that one, because to them, this is direct corroboration of Robert's story. The taillight was broken. Reed saw it. She allegedly recognized the pieces. She admitted they came from her car. And almost the most damning of all, she admitted that they were right there at the scene at that time. Not planted after. There. Before anyone had access to her car. Before it went to the Sallyport, the damage was there. From a purely tactical perspective, that's the kind of exhibit that earns a gold star on the prosecution storyboard. It ties the vehicle to the location, and it shows knowledge. It implies cause, and it's not coming from an investigator or a witness trying to remember the chaos. It's coming from the defendant herself. Still, Jackson isn't about to let that sit uncontested for long. Well, he didn't launch a full assault on the recording in open court yet. You can bet it's marked with a big O-X in his notes. If the defense is going to argue evidence tampering or investigative misconduct, they'll need to neutralize that clip. Maybe they'll say it was a misstatement. Maybe they'll argue she didn't know what she was picking up. Maybe they'll go after the context of the interview itself. Either way, it's coming. But for now, on day two, The prosecution is firmly in the driver's seat. They've got Reed allegedly asking if she hit O'Keefe. They've got a friend testifying that Reed knew her taillight was busted, and they've got a defendant herself on record describing those fragments showing up in the very spot where O'Keefe was found. If you're a juror, that's a lot of puzzle pieces. It's a lot of puzzle pieces that are starting to look like a picture. Of course, none of this proves intent. Doesn't tell us what happened in that driveway or what Karen actually remembers from that night. But what it does show is the direction the prosecution is steering this case and the foundation that they're building it on. As we continue, the tone in the courtroom starts to shift. The focus has moved from hypotheticals and timelines to something more visceral. Words, fragments, and raw panic. Whether those words point to guilt or confusion is a question still hanging in the air, but it is clear that the prosecution is betting everything on the idea that what Karen Reed said and what she allegedly picked up from that snowy driveway will speak louder than any witness ever could. Next up, that panic gives way to something even more emotional. Mother takes the stand. The words she recalls might be even harder for the jury to forget. There's moments in a courtroom that don't need legal jargon or forensic charts to hit hard. Moments that don't require expert testimony or cell phone data dumps. Sometimes it all comes down to one thing. It just takes a mother's voice. Tired, broken, still reeling from the shock of a life forever altered. That was the atmosphere when Margaret Peggy O'Keefe took the stand on day two of the Karen Reed trial. Up until this point, the prosecution had been methodically laying down its case, including fragments of plastic, playing audio clips, pulling threads in Karen Reed's own words. But when Peggy O'Keefe walked into the witness box, the room changed. This wasn't about evidence tags anymore. This was about a mother testifying not as a legal tool, but as someone who lost her son. Peggy O'Keefe had never testified during the first trial. That alone made her appearance on the retrial a notable shift in the prosecution's approach. This time they wanted jurors not to just understand the facts, but to feel the weight of them. And who better to deliver that than the woman who's raised the man whose death has brought them all to this courtroom? Her voice was quiet at first, maybe not from nerves, but from emotion. She described the chaos of January 29th, 2022, the day John O'Keefe was found in the snow. The moment she saw Karen Reed at the hospital is one she says that she'll never forget. According to Peggy, Reed was frantic, yelling down the hallway, "Peg, is he dead? Is he dead, Peg?" It was a haunting question, one that at face value could be seen as pure panic. A girlfriend desperate to know if her partner was still alive, but in the prosecution's eyes, it was more than that. They framed it as another moment, like, did I hit him, panic, earlier that morning, where Reed was not just reacting, but revealing something deeper. Maybe not a confession, but something closer to acknowledgement. Peggy continued recounting her own confusion in that moment. Her son was dying or already gone. And here was Karen Reed shouting down a hospital corridor, needing an answer, like she already feared. According to Peggy, what followed was a quiet confrontation. She said she asked Karen directly, "What happened? How did John end up like this?" And the answer Peggy testified was blunt. Karen allegedly told her, "We went to a party. I left him there." That simple sentence, six words, became another cornerstone in the prosecution's narrative. It placed Karen at the scene. It admitted she left John behind. And in the state's view, it hinted at a level of responsibility. Now, to be clear, "I left him there" doesn't tell us why she left or even how she felt about it at that time. But what it does provide is context. If taken at face value, it confirms that Reed didn't take John home with her. And paired with earlier testimony, the broken taillight, the driveway discovery, the frantic questions, it starts to form a shape of the prosecution is hoping the jury can't ignore. But it wasn't just the words that made Peggy's testimony powerful. It was the way she told the story. She wept openly on the stand, described what it was like to hear those words. And when she spoke about what happened next, her pain seemed to deepen. Later that same day, after the hospital, Peggy said Karen Reed came to the O'Keefe family home. She wasn't alone. She brought her father and brother with her. And they asked Peggy if they could go upstairs to John's room to retrieve some of Karen's belongings. You know, like you do after a breakup. Or a death. At that point, Peggy was in no state to argue. Her family was in shock. John's niece and nephew, who he had been raising, were devastated. The house was filled with grief and confusion. So Peggy said yes. What followed, though, clearly, it stuck with her. She told the court that she let them go upstairs unsupervised. She didn't watch what they took. She didn't check afterwards. In her words, I should never have let them go up there, but at the time, I just couldn't think straight. That line, I never should have let them go up there, hung in the air for a beat or two. Because while Karen, or rather, while Peggy never accused Karen of removing anything specific, that phrase carried a subtle charge, a sense of regret, maybe even suspicion. The prosecution didn't press the issue. They didn't need to. That unease was already doing its job. It was a clever move from a courtroom strategy standpoint. By letting Peggy speak freely and emotionally, they allowed her to cast a gentle cloud over Reed's actions without making outright accusations. It wasn't about proving that something had been taken from the room. It was about letting the jury feel the tension, letting them wonder why someone would need to go back to the room of a man who had just died, unsupervised, so quickly. And yet, for all the potential implications in her testimony, the defense didn't fight her on it at all. There was no combative cross-examination, no attempts to poke holes in her memory or suggest she misunderstood what she heard. Alan Jackson, Reed's attorney, kept it brief. Maybe he knew there was no winning in that moment. You don't cross-examine a grieving mother unless you absolutely have to, and even then, it's a tightrope over lava. So instead of attacking, the defense let her word stand. They didn't challenge the "is he dead" quote. They didn't contest the "I left him there" admission. Instead, they let the prosecution burn its emotional fuel. Like planning to return, though, later, to reframe those moments of desperation, not guilt. Peggy's testimony didn't come with hard evidence. There were no diagrams or photos, no timestamps or GPS data. But what it did offer was something else entirely. Credibility. She wasn't a trained witness. She wasn't a first responder or an expert. She was just a mom who lost her son and remembered what was said in the hours after his death. Sometimes that's more powerful than any exhibit. By the end of her time on the stand, the jury had been taken through the before, during, and after of what was possibly the worst day of her life. They heard her confusion, her confrontation, her regrets. They saw her cry. They saw her pause. And through it all, they saw someone trying to make sense of how her son had ended up dead in the snow. As the court recessed and witnesses shifted, it was clear that the prosecution had achieved something important. They had moved the story from pieces of evidence to people, from fragments of taillights to fragments of memory. And in doing so, they reminded everyone in that room what the case is really about. But emotion, no matter how raw, isn't always enough to convict. You still need facts. You still need something to anchor the tears to the timeline. And that's where things are about to head next, because what came after Peggy O'Keefe's testimony was colder, less personal, but no less important. When the prosecution turned to technical experts and first responders, the story took a shift from grief to data. And that shift would open a whole new angle on what really happened that night. By the time the courtroom returned from the emotional gravity of Peggy O'Keefe's testimony, the atmosphere had noticeably shifted. The jury had heard the personal, had seen the grief, but now it was time to move into the part of the story where things got less about emotion and more about evidence. Not the kind you can feel, but the kind you can log, timestamp, download, and cross-reference. Enter Massachusetts State Police Trooper Nicholas Garano. Garano isn't a flashy witness. He doesn't arrive with tear-stained stories or tear-stained stories or shocking confessions. He's a digital evidence specialist, someone whose job is quite literally to find truth in the ones and zeros we've all left behind. Every call, every ping, every app that runs in the background, it all tells a story, even if we don't mean it to. And in the case of Karen Reed, prosecutors wanted the jury to see that her phone and the phones around her could help them understand what happened on the night John O'Keefe died. Grana began by walking the court through the basic process of what he does. He extracts, he analyzes digital data from mobile devices using forensic tools to preserve, decode, and interpret what's on a phone without altering its contents. In this case, he pulled data from several phones, Karen's, Reed's, John O'Keefe's, and a few from key individuals present that night, including Carrie Roberts and Jennifer McCabe. Now, it's important to say right here and right up front, Garano isn't or didn't bring any sort of smoking gun with him. There's no single damning text message, no midnight confession, no location ping screaming, "Here's the moment everything went wrong." What he did bring was structure, a digital scaffolding that allowed the prosecution to lay out the timeline. Built on who texted who, when, and where, the phones were located at key points during the night and early morning hours. For instance, Garano confirmed timestamps from when Karen Reed was texting and calling friends while she searched for O'Keefe. He also mapped out which towers her phone connected to, showing her general location through all the early morning hours. All of it was meant to align with earlier witness testimony, specifically Carrie Roberts' account of how Reed was driving around Canton in a state of panic, making calls, trying to find John. None of it contradicted what had already been heard, and that in itself was a win for the prosecution, because if they can prove that her phone behavior matched the timeline laid out by their witnesses, especially the ones saying Reed seemed panic, frantic, and disoriented, it helps lock the narrative into place. It's one thing to have a witness say, "She was texting me at 4:15 a.m. It's another thing entirely to have a forensic analyst pull the same timestamp directly from the phone, unaltered, and present it under oath. And that's what happened today. But again, we're not talking bombshells. We're talking architecture. Think of Garano's testimony like the studs inside the walls of your house. You don't really notice them, but without them, nothing else holds up. The defense didn't touch any major attacks, didn't take any major attacks during cross. There wasn't really anything to challenge at this moment. Garano didn't make conclusions. He just presented data. So defense likely saw this as more of a pilot for later moment, knowing they might need to reference the timing of texts or the absence of specific messages when it's their turn to present. With Garano off the stand, the prosecution moved to another piece of the puzzle, this one not digital, but human. paramedic Daniel Whitley from the Canton Fire Department. Whitley wasn't called to analyze anything. He wasn't there to explain injury patterns or talk about cause of death. He was there because he was on the scene the morning John O'Keefe was found, part of the team that responds to that chaotic 911 call on Fairview Road. His role was simple: tell the court what he saw and what he did. And what he saw, according to his testimony, was Karen Reed in a state of emotional collapse. Whitley described arriving at the scene and finding Reed frantic, pacing, sobbing, and at times completely unglued. She wasn't calm. She wasn't answering questions clearly. She was spiraling. He said she was visibly upset, shouting, and appeared unable to control her emotions. And because of that, authorities on the scene made a decision. Karen Reed needed to be transported to the hospital, not for physical injuries, but for a psychiatric evaluation. Now, that might sound dramatic, but in emergency response terms, it's not unheard of. When someone is in an emotional shock or displaying signs of mental distress after a traumatic event, paramedics may recommend or be ordered to bring them in for further observation. Doesn't mean the person is unstable, and it clearly doesn't mean they're guilty of anything. It just means the situation was severe enough to warrant medical oversight. Still, Whitley's testimony was important to the prosecution story, not because it proved anything directly about the cause of O'Keefe's death, but because it added yet another layer to Karen Reed's behavior that morning, another data point suggesting she was overwhelmed, out of control, and very aware of the severity of what had just happened. He didn't say she confessed. He didn't say she told him what she'd done, but he did say that she was so visibly distraught that medical personnel felt she couldn't be left alone. And that image, combined with testimony from Carrie Roberts and Peggy O'Keefe earlier in the day, starts to form a consistent thread. Karen Reed, in the hours after John O'Keefe was found, was not functioning like someone who was simply confused or inconvenienced. She was, as multiple witnesses now say, panicked, desperate, and shaken to her core. But that's where things start to diverge, depending on who you ask. The prosecution wants the jury to see that behavior as a kind of subconscious admission that she was distraught because she knew, maybe not consciously, maybe not clearly, but at some level, she knew she had done something catastrophic. That's why they've called in multiple people to the stand, just to testify about her emotional state. Because they're building a case not just from what she did, but from how she reacted afterwards. But the defense, they're laying groundwork too, because they're going to argue that those same behaviors, crying, panicking, and even asking to be taken to the hospital, aren't indicators of guilt. They're indicators of trauma. And if you believe that Karen Reed didn't know what happened to John O'Keefe, it was, if you believe she didn't hit him with her car, then that level of panic makes perfect sense. She wasn't melting down because she got caught. She was melting down because the man she loved was dying. And she didn't know why. They didn't push back hard on Whitley's account either. No accusations that he got it wrong. No cross-examination meant to cast doubt on his motives, much like with Peggy O'Keefe's testimony. The defense seemed to understand the challenging nature of all this, that challenging this witness head-on might also backfire. Better to let the facts sit and save their interpretation for later. And that's where the day's testimony left things. A digital trail that reinforced a timeline of first responder who described a woman emotionally unraveling. No fireworks, no shocking reversals, but a carefully constructed layer of support for the prosecution's overall theory. Each witness, whether they knew it or not, was adding weight to the idea that this wasn't just a tragic accident. It was an unraveling of guilt, grief, and maybe, depending on which side of the courtroom you believe, an attempt to cover up what really happened in that driveway. And as the day closed, the evidence shifted from panic to pattern, from words and worry to data and demeanor. It was no longer just about what Karen Reed said in a moment of fear. Now it was about what her phone remembered, what her body showed, and what the professionals on scene decided had to be done. That's day two. What are your thoughts? Let us know in the comments. We'd love to hear it on YouTube. If you're listening to the podcast, be sure to check out our YouTube channel. If you would, just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, and you can join in the conversation right there. And press subscribe wherever you're listening or watching us on YouTube, on whatever podcast platform, and do it vice versa. So you can get a little bit of both. You get the videos on YouTube, and then you can, of course, take us anywhere you want and listen anywhere you want through Apple Podcasts or wherever you get podcasts. Looking forward to seeing those comments. I am Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again very, very soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today.